The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 6.
Chapter 11. Crime Scenes. I don't function well in the small hours of the morning. I sleep like a log, and I have difficulty pulling my wits about me if something wakes me in the pre-dawn dark. So it takes me a few seconds to sit up and grab the bedside phone when it begins to snarl for attention. I fumble the handset close to my face.
What?
I managed to drone, thinking, if this is a telesales call, I'll plead justifiable homicide, as Mo spasms violently in a twist of the duvet and rolls over, pulling the bedding off me.
Bob.
I know that voice. It's Joe here, Code Blue. How soon can you be ready for a pickup? I'm abruptly awake in an icy cold drench of sweat.
5 minutes, I croak. What's up?
I want you in here stat, and I'm sending a car. Be ready in 5 minutes. She sounds uncertain. Afraid? This line isn't secure, so save your questions. Okay. The phrase, this had better be good, doesn't even reach my larynx. Declaring Code Blue is the sort of thing that attracts the auditor's attention.
Bye.
I put the phone down.
What was that?
Says Mo.
That was a Code Blue.
I swing my feet over the edge of the bed and fish for yesterday's discarded socks. There's a car calling for me in 5 minutes.
Shit.
Mo rolls over the other way and buries her face in a pillow.
Am I wanted?
Her voice, muffled, trails away. Just me. I pour through an open drawer for pants. It's Joe Sullivan, at 4 in the morning.
She's with Oscar Oscar, isn't she?
Yep. Pants on. T-shirt on. Trousers next in queue.
You'd better go.
She sounds serious. Phone me the instant you hear something. I glance at the alarm. It's 4:40.
I don't mind.
She pulls the bedding into shape.
Take care.
And you, I say, as I head downstairs, carrying my holstered pistol. I'm standing in the front hall when blue and red strobes light up the window glass above the door. I open it in the face of a cop.
Mr. Howard?
She asks. That's me. I hold up my warrant card and her eyes age a little.
Come with me, please,
she says, and opens the rear door for me. I strap myself in and we're off for another strobe-lit taxi ride through the wilds of South London, speeding alarmingly down narrow shuttered streets and careening around roundabouts in the grey pre-dawn light, until, after a surprisingly short time, we pull up outside the staff entrance to a certain store. The door is open. Joe is waiting for me. One look at her face tells me it's bad. Angleton warned me. This is where it starts. I tense. What's happened? I ask.
Come this way.
Joe leads me up the stairwell. The lights are on, which is abnormal, and I hear footsteps. Not the steady shuffle of the night staff, but boots and raised voices. Something in the air makes me think of a kicked anthill. We head past reception, where a couple of blue-suited security men are standing guard over a stapler and 6 paperclips, then back along the corridor past Iris's corner office, then round the bend to... Fuck, I say, unable to contain myself. My office door is closed, but I can see the interior, because there's a gigantic hole in the door, as if someone hit it with a wrecking ball. Except a wrecking ball would leave rough, jagged edges of splintered wood, while the rim of this particular hole looks oddly melted. The interior isn't much better. An avalanche of paper and scraps of broken metal are strewn across half an overturned desk. A thin blue glow clings patchily to some of the wreckage, fading slowly even as I watch. What happened?
I'm hoping you'll tell us.
It's Boris. Bags under his eyes and an expression as dark as midnight on the winter solstice. When did he get back? Wasn't he doing something overseas connected with Bloody Baron? What have you done, Bob? Joe grabs my left elbow. First a civilian FATAC, now this. What are you into? I blink stupidly at the destruction.
My secure document safe, is it?
She shakes her head.
We won't know until we go inside. It's still active.
I feel a thin prickling on the back of my neck. Demonic intruders have been at work, summoned to retrieve something. Angleton was right, I realize.
What did you have in your safe?
I'm not sure you're cleared.
Boris clears his throat.
Is cleared, Bob. I will clear her. What was in safe? What attracted attention of burglars in night?
I squint through the hole in the door. I had documents relating to several code word projects in there, I say. The stacks can probably reconstruct my withdrawal record, and once it's safe to go in there, we can work out what is missing.
Bob, you went to the archives in person yesterday.
Jo tightens her grip on my elbow, painfully tight.
What did you withdraw most recently? Tell us.
Truth and consequences time. I asked for a copy of the Fuller Memorandum, I tell her, which is entirely true and correct. I was following up something Angleton told me to do a while ago, which is also entirely correct, and the most misleading thing I've said in front of witnesses all year.
Fuller Memo...
I see a flicker of recognition on Boris's face.
Tell me, when you go home last night, is Fuller Memorandum in safe?
I nod. I don't trust my tongue at this point because, as the man who used to be president said, it all depends on what you mean by the word is. Jo stares at Boris.
What classification level are we talking about?
She asks. Boris doesn't answer at once. He's staring at me, and if looks could kill, I'd be a tiny pile of ash right now.
Does Angleton say you are to the memorandum read?
He asks. Yep. It took me a while to track it down, I extemporize. So I left it in the safe overnight. I was going to look at it today. All of which is truthful enough that I will happily repeat it in front of an audit panel, knowing that if I tell a lie in front of them, the blood will boil in my veins and I won't die. Boris looks at Joe and nods minutely.
I'm thanking you for calling me. This is mess.
What was in the memo that's so red hot? I ask, pushing my luck, because somewhere in all the fuss of expediting Angleton's little scheme, taking the forgery he'd prepared and inserting it into the archives, then withdrawing it and planting the bait in my office safe, I hadn't gotten round to asking him just what the original was about.
Memorandum is control binding scripture for asset called Eater of Souls, Boris says, and strangely he refuses to meet my eyes. Code word is teapot. Consequences of loss. Unspeakable.
Oh, shit.
I swear with feeling, because I'm not totally stupid. I worked out who Teapot was some time ago. I didn't realize the Fuller Memorandum was his control document, though. The control document is the source code and activation signature for the Gesh that binds the entity called Teapot, the thing that over an 80-year span became Angleton. It doesn't even matter that our safebreakers have stolen a ringer. At least, I assume Angleton gave me a ringer. The fact that they knew what to look for in the first place is really bad news.
You'd better come with me,
says Jo, and I suddenly notice that she's shifted her grip to my forearm, and she's got fingers like handcuffs.
Form R60 time, Bob, and this time it's not just a FATAC inquiry. As soon as my people have gone over the incident scene with a fine-toothed comb, this will be going before the auditors. I'm sorry.
I do not pass go, do not collect £200, and do not buy Piccadilly Circus. I don't go to jail, either. Not yet. But by the middle of the morning, a 30-year stretch in Wormwood Scrubs would come as a blessed relief.
Committee of Inquiry will come to order.
I've been here before, and I didn't like it the first time. The panel has requisitioned a small conference room, furnished in 90s government brutalist light, Aeron chairs and bleached pine table, health and safety posters on one wall, security notices on the other. The tribunal sits at the far end of the table, like a pinstriped hanging judge and his assistants. And they've rolled out that fucking carpet again, the one with the gold thread design woven into it, and the Enochian inscription, and the live summoning grid powerful enough to twist tendons and snap bones. There is no peanut gallery at this trial. Joe is waiting outside with a couple of blue suitors and the other designated witnesses, but the auditors want no inconvenient onlookers who might have to be bound to silence or memory wiped, should I accidentally disclose material above their level of classification.
Please state your name and job title.
There's a recorder on the desk, as usual. Its light is glowing red. Bob Howard, Senior Specialist Officer Grade 3, Personal Assistant to T... DSS Angleton. That causes a minor stir. One of the auditors, female, blonde, late 40s, turns sideways and says something to the others that I ought to be able to hear, but can't. The other two nod. She turns back and addresses me directly.
Mr. Howard, you are aware of the terms of this investigation. You are aware of the GESH it is conducted under. You have our special dispensation to respond to any question the first time it is posed, and only the first time, by warning us if, in your judgment, the reply would require you to disclose code word classified information. Please state your understanding of this variance in your own words.
I clear my throat. If you ask me about sensitive projects, I'm allowed to stonewall, once. If you ask me again, I have to tell you, period. I assume that's because you'd prefer to keep the inquiry from accidentally covering so many highly classified subjects that nobody is allowed to read its findings? She smiles dryly.
Something like that.
It feels like the angel of death has just perched on my shoulder, paused from sharpening its blade, and quietly squawked.
Who's a pretty Polly?
Then the sense of imminent ridiculous demise passes.
Ha ha, I slay myself.
The chief auditor nods, then looks at the legal pad before him.
Yesterday you visited the library front desk. What was your objective?
Lie back and think of England, and nothing else. Angleton gave me a reading list, I said. He told me to bring back a particular document.
Pause.
Oh, and Mo wanted me to pick up a copy of a report she'd asked for, but it wasn't in yet. There is no prickling of high-tension current in my legs to warn me that my partial truth is unacceptable.
Who is Mo?
Asks Auditor Number 3. Dr. Dominique O'Brien, Epistemological Warfare Specialist, Grade 4. Auditor 3 leans forward hungrily.
Why did this person ask you to collect a document on their behalf?
He demands. I blink, nonplussed. Because I told her I was going to the library, and she was busy. She's my wife. Auditor Number 3 looks baffled for a few seconds, his bloodhound trail evaporating in a haze of aniseed fumes.
You're married?
Yes. This would be hilarious if I wasn't scared silly by the sleeping horror I am standing on that will sense any attempt at deception and...
Oh.
He makes a note on his pad and subsides. The blonde auditor gives him a very old-fashioned look, then turns to me.
Are you cleared for the content of her work?
She asks.
Huh?
I have no idea, I say sincerely. We only discuss projects we're working on after comparing code word access and, if necessary, asking for clearance. Then the glyph on the goddamn rug forces me to add, but this time it doesn't matter, the document hadn't arrived anyway. She scribbles something on her own notepad.
Did Dr. O'Brien tell you anything about this particular note?
She asks. I blink. I have no idea. She simply gave me the file reference number. No code word. More notes, more significant looks. The senior auditor stares at me over the gold half-moon rims of his spectacles.
Mr. Howard, please indicate if you are familiar with any of these individuals. Matthias Hoechst, Jessica Morgenstern, George Dower... Nikolai Panin.
He nods at my hand signal.
Describe what you know about Nikolai Panin.
I had a pint with him in the Frog and Tourette's the day before yesterday. The effect is astonishing. The auditors jerk to attention like a row of frogs with cattle prods up their backsides. I meet their appalled gaze with a sense of sublime lightness. They want the truth? Okay, they can fucking have the truth. I reported it as a contact to the Bloody Baron Committee at the first opportunity, and it was agreed to keep it quiet for the time being. Panin seems to have wanted to pass on a warning about Teapot. He was concerned that it was missing, and that as its last custodians, we ought to ensure it was found before the wrong persons got their hands on it and, made tea. I smile blandly. Angleton authorized me to read the White Baron files, and I have inferred the identity of Teapot. The chief auditor shakes his head.
Bloody hell,
he grumbles. Then to me,
do you know where Angleton is?
I open my mouth, then pause. Now I can feel the electric flare of the Gesh tickling the fine hairs on my legs. The blonde auditor narrows her eyes.
Speak,
she commands. I can't not speak, but I still have some control. I don't believe Angleton has assigned it a code word yet, I hear myself saying, but his disappearance is connected with an ongoing investigation, and I don't think he wants me to tell anyone about it. My legs feel as if they're immersed in cold fire up to the knees. I gasp for breath, just as the chief auditor hastily holds up his hand.
Stay of execution. The subject has invoked the security variance.
He peers at me.
Can you confirm that you are cognizant of Angleton's whereabouts?
I nod jerkily. The chilly, searing fingers recede down my calves.
In your judgment, is Angleton working in the best interests of this institution?
I nod like a parcel shelf ornament.
Also, in your judgment, would it impair his work on behalf of this institution if we continue to explore this line of inquiry?
I think for a moment, then I nod emphatically.
Very well.
Light glints on his spectacles as he looks at me for a few seconds.
On your recommendation, we will not inquire further, unless you have something you would like to tell us.
Careful, Bob. This is an audit board you're up against. They're at their most dangerous when they're being reasonable, and they can turn all the fires of hell, imaginary or otherwise, on you if you don't cooperate. I take a deep breath. I'm confused, I finally say. I thought this was an inquiry about the break-in and theft from my office safe, but you've been asking questions about Angleton and Moe instead. What's going on? Wrong question. Auditor number 3 smiles sharkishly, and the blonde auditor shakes her head.
It is not in the remit of this committee to answer questions, says the chief auditor a trifle archly. Now, back to the matter in hand. I have some questions about office supplies. When did you last order stationery fasteners from office stores, and how many and what type did you request?
While I'm being hauled over the coals, Mo rises at her usual hour, makes coffee, eats a cereal bar, reads my text message. It's along the lines of, held up at work in committee. She frowns, worried but not unduly alarmed. My texts range from verbose and eloquent, when I'm bored, to monosyllabic, when the entire cesspit is about to be ingested by a jet engine. This intermediate level is indicative of stress, but not of mortal danger. She leaves the dregs of the coffee in the pot and the cereal bar wrapper on top of the other waste in the kitchen bin. She goes upstairs, dresses, collects violin and coat, and leaves. Sometimes Mo works in the new annex, and sometimes she doesn't. There's an office in the Royal College of Music where her name is one of 3 listed on the door. There's a course in philosophy of mathematics at King's College where she sometimes lectures and forwards reports on her pupils to human resources. And she's a regular visitor at the village, across the fens and up the coast by boat, where the laundry keeps certain assets that don't belong in a crowded city. Today, she sets out by tube, heading for the city centre. She's on her way to ask Mr. Dower whether he did in fact mail his report, and she is in for a surprise. Watch the red-haired woman in a black suit, violin case in hand, walking up the pavement towards the shuttered shopfront with the blue and white police incident tape stretched across the doorway. Traffic cones with more tape stand to either side of the shopfront, fluttering in the light breeze. She pauses, nonplussed, then looks around. There is a police officer standing discreetly by, hands clasped behind his back. She glances back at the taped-off doorway. There is no dark stain on the lintel. The SOC officers and the cleanup crew did their job well, but the ward she wears under her blouse buzzes a warning. Her expression hardens, and she walks towards the constable, reaching into her handbag to produce an identity card.
What happened here, officer?
She asks quietly, holding the card where he can't help but see it. He doesn't stand a chance.
Oh, dear. He shakes his head. Ma'am, murder scene. You can't go. I mean, you shouldn't.
Who's in charge here? She inquires. Where can I find them?
That'd be D.I. Wolf from MIT4. He set up shop round the back, that way, that alley there. Who should I say?
In the name of national security, I command and require you to forget me,
she says, slipping the card away and turning towards the alley that runs around to the back of the row of four shops. The constable's eyes close momentarily. By the time he opens them again, the woman with the violin case is gone. 10 minutes later, the back door to George Dower's shop clicks open. Two figures step inside, a uniformed detective sergeant and the woman. Both of them wear disposable polythene slippers over their shoes. She still holds her violin case.
"Don't touch anything. Tell me what you want to look at," he says,
pulling on a pair of disposable gloves.
"What exactly are you after?"
"First of all, what state is his PC in?"
"It wasn't stolen, so he bagged it."
The sergeant sounds sure of himself.
"If you're wanting to scrape the hard drive, we can have an image of it available in an hour or so."
Mo cools slightly. If the killer left the PC behind, then there's almost certainly nothing left on it but random garbage, an entropic mess that not even CESG will be able to unerase. "Any memory sticks? Small stuff? CDRs?"
"We bagged them too."
The sergeant picks his way into Dower's workshop, which still reeks of rosin and varnish. A row of disemboweled instruments hang from a rail overhead, like corpses in the dissectionist's cold parlour. Those tools that are not in their places on the pegboard that covers one wall are laid out on the bench in parallel rows, neatly sorted by size. The metal parts gleam like surgical steel, polished and unnaturally bright. "Any papers?" The sergeant pauses beside a roll-top desk, itself an antique Victorian or Edwardian.
"Yes," he says reluctantly. "They're scheduled for pickup tomorrow, so we can continue working on the contact list. Receipts, supplies, brochures, estimates, that sort of thing."
"I'm looking for an appraisal of a customer's instrument," she tells him. "It'll be dated yesterday or the day before, and it relates to a violin. It may be in an unmarked envelope, like this one."
She produces an envelope from her bag.
"Like that?"
The officer's eyes widen and his back straightens.
"Would you happen to have any information about the killer?" he asks. "Because if so..."
Mo shakes her head.
"I do not know who the killer is."
The sergeant stares at her, seeking eye contact.
"The victim was commissioned to prepare a report for my department. He was due to post it on the evening when the incident occurred. It has not been delivered."
"What was he meant to report on?"
Mo makes eye contact at last, and the detective sergeant recoils slightly from whatever he sees in her expression.
"You have no need to know. If it appears that there is a connection between the report and the killing, my department will notify Inspector Wolfe immediately. Similarly, if the identity of the killer comes to our attention."
She doesn't add, "in such a way that we can disclose it without violating security protocol." That much is always understood to be a minor chord in the uneasy duet of spook and cop.
"The report, however, is a classified document and should be treated as such."
And she raises her warrant card again. The detective sergeant is clearly torn between the urgent desire to get her into an interview room and the equally urgent desire to get her the hell out of this shop and away from what was, until a few minutes ago, a straightforward, if rather unusual, murder investigation. But being on the receiving end of a laundry warrant card is an oh shit moment. It begins with the phrase, "Her Britannic Majesty's government commands and compels you to provide the bearer of this pass with all aid and assistance," written atop a design of such subtle and mind-numbing power that it makes the reader's breath catch in his throat as suddenly as if trapped by a hangman's noose. He can no more ignore it, and no more ignore her instructions, than he can ignore a gun pointed at his head.
"What do you want?" he finally asks.
"I want the contents of that report."
She lowers her card.
"I suspect the killer doesn't want me to have it, so if you find it, call me."
She produces a business card, and he takes it. Then her roving gaze settles on the desk.
"Oh, and one other thing. Are there any paper clips or staples in there? Because if so, I want them all."
"Paper clips?"
"Yes, I want all the paper clips and staples in that desk."
Her cheek quirks.
"Mr. Dower was the type to fasten a report together before folding it and putting it in an envelope. And where there's a link, there's a chain of evidence."
The audit board chews me up and spits me out in less than an hour. Light as thistledown and dry as a dead man's tongue, I walk through the door, past the seated witnesses, the blue suitors are collecting chaudhry now, ushering him into the presence, and drift on stumbling feet towards my office. Except I don't get very far. Instead, I bump up against a blue translucent bubble that seems to have swallowed the corridor and everything in it just before Iris's office door. The bubble is warm and rubbery, and I have a feeling that it would be a very bad idea indeed to try and bull my way through it. So I turn round and go back the other way, towards the coffee station. I'm just scooping brown powder into a filter cone. The jug was empty right when I most needed it, as usual, when Iris clears her throat behind me. "I've been audited," I say, in answer to her silent question. "I don't think it went badly, but I gather I'm not allowed back in my office just yet." "No one is," she says, surprisingly calmly. "Are you making a fresh pot?" "Sure." I slide the basket back into the coffee maker and hit the brew button. Iris watches me silently. "As a matter of fact, you won't be going back to work for a bit," she says. "What?" The coffee machine clears its throat behind me as I stare at her. "The civilian FATAC incident when you were out at Cosford has been upgraded." Her expression is apologetic. "Sorry doesn't begin to cut it, I know, but the incident committee has escalated it to internal affairs, and they actioned me to notify you that you're being suspended on full pay pending a full hearing."
"They're what?"
I hear my voice rise uncontrollably, cracked.
"But what about Angleton's plan?"
"But it's not a FATAC anymore."
"Bob."
"Bob? Calm down. This isn't the end of the world. I'm sure the hearing will exonerate you. They don't want you in the office until it's over. It's just a routine precaution."
"Bob?"
She's talking to my back. I'm halfway down the corridor by the time she says my name, then round the bend and halfway down the twist that takes me to the stairwell to Angleton's office. Because fuck Helen Langhorne and her KGB sleeper medals, part of me is swearing furiously. I know damn well that I'm going to be exonerated, because the victim wasn't a victim. She was a hostile agent who poked her nose into an off-limits area at the wrong time. So the question is, why now? And there's only one species of answer that fits. I take the stairs two at a time, thudding down them hard enough to raise dust from the elderly carpet, bouncing off the banister rail and caroming up against the door. I raise my phone and squint through its magic mirror eye, seeing that the wards are merely the usual ones, and then I twist the doorknob and push. "Boss?" I glance around the empty room. The Mimek sits in its corner, hulking like a sleeping baby elephant. The filing cabinets are all neatly shut and sealed. "Boss?" He's not here. My spine crawls. Need to leave him a message. I head for the Memex and slide into the operator's seat. "Right clearance." I foot type teapot and wait for the soul mangling symbol to disappear. "Right." The menu prompt is empty. "Message," I type. The prompt changes and I keep going. "Boss, they took the bait. Problem. IA are suspending me over Cosford. Auditors more interested in paperclips. My mobile number is..." Angleton isn't a total technophobe. As long as he has my phone number, he can get in touch. But now I've got another problem. I'm not supposed to be here. So I switch off the Memex carefully and stand up, and I'm just on the point of tiptoeing out of the room when two blue suitors appear out of nowhere and grab my wrists.
"Careful now, sir. We wouldn't want to make a fuss, would we?"
I look past his shoulder at Iris. She looks concerned.
"Bob, what are you doing? Didn't I tell you you were being suspended?"
I pant for breath. My heart's hammering and my palms are slippery. "I was hoping Angleton..." She shakes her head sympathetically, then tuts to herself.
"I think you're overwrought. He's been having a bad time lately," she explains to the blue suitors. "You need to go home and relax badly, don't you, Bob?"
I can take a hint. I nod. Blue suit number two clears his throat apologetically.
"If he's not cleared for this room, ma'am," he begins.
"No, that's all right,"
Iris says, casting me a quelling look.
He was personal secretary to DSS Angleton. He's cleared for this room, and he's not required to be off the premises until noon, and he obviously hasn't touched anything."
I blink at that, but keep my mouth shut.
"So you may feel free to report it, but he hasn't actually violated the security articles. Yet.
She taps her wristwatch.
Not for another 9 minutes. So I suggest you might want to take a deep breath and let these gentlemen escort you to the front door, Bob.
She's right. I really don't want to still be in the building when my permission is suspended. The consequences would be drastic and painful, I imagine. I'll go quietly, I hear myself saying, if you'd like to lead the way. At 12:30 exactly, I find myself standing alone in the middle of a concrete emptiness, the blurred ghosts of shoppers darting around me like shadows beneath a pitiless sun. I can't remember how I came to this place. My hands are shaking and I can't see the future. All I can see is grey. The sun is beating down, but I'm cold inside. I keep seeing a purple flash, the old woman's face rotting and flaking and shrinking around her skull before me. The thing on the bike path, growling deep in its throat. They took my pistol.
Don't want you to go carrying that around when you're all depressed, sir, the blue suitor told me.
I'd phone Mo and ask her to pick up another ward if I wasn't feeling so frustrated and ineffectual. Everything's fallen apart at the very worst time, and it's all my fault. Item. There is a security breach. The Free Church of the Universal Kingdom, hereafter and forevermore to be known as the Goatfuckers, because that's the least of what they get up to, and I don't want to think about them eating the blonde teacher's face, have got an informer inside the laundry. I walk past a bus stop and an overflowing litter bin, the ashtray on its lid smoking and fulminating. There's a disgusting stench of cheap tobacco and smouldering filter wadding. A convoy of buses rumbles past slowly, like a troop of implausibly red elephants walking trunk to tail. Item. They followed Mo home, and they're following me. And unless I'm very much mistaken, they want the key that binds the Eater of Souls, which is probably one of our most powerful weapons, disguised as a public schoolmaster indeed. There's a rundown concrete suburban shopping mall here, a brutalist plaza surrounded by walkways overlooking cheap supermarkets, an off-license and a shuttered chemist's. Abandoned disposable carrier bags clog the gutters. I walk beneath a bridge between two piers and up an arcade walled by the display windows of empty shop units, as grimy as my sense of self-worth. Item. The Goatfuckers aren't the only people who are into the laundry. Punin and the 13th Directorate clearly know a lot more than I do about the Codicil Black Skull Flights, 666 Squadron, and the Eater of Souls, who keeps cropping up in this mess like a bad penny. And anything that worries the KGB ought to worry the hell out of me, too. I come out of the arcade in a wide alley lined with loading bays, rusting metal shutters drawn down across concrete slabs. Overflowing dumpsters, redolent with the sweet feta of dead rats, lean between scraped and battered steel bollards, huddling together like school kids sharing a fag behind the bike shed. The sky is clouding over, the merciless sun shrouded by dirty clouds of doubtful provenance. I keep walking. Item. The auditors wanted to know about Mo and about paperclips. I know about paperclips and why they're a security risk. The laws of contagion and sympathy are fundamental to all systems of magic. Quantum entanglement and spooky action at a distance for the witch doctor set. More prosaically, if you've got a paperclip from the same box as a sibling that's clipped to a top secret file, you figure it out, okay? But why did they want to know about Mo? What was the document she wanted me to retrieve? Am I missing something? What if it's not all about me or Angleton? The business in St. Martin a few years ago should have been a wake-up call. Just because I'm under investigation, it doesn't mean she... The hell I'm under investigation. No, I'm under suspicion. But suspicion of what? My feet carry me past the end of the delivery alley and across a road where a cast-iron railway bridge shadows the terraced houses, their fronts smeared with smuts from the diesel locomotives that rumble overhead, freighting coal to the power stations that keep the lights burning and the hard drives turning. There is a cycle path here, and my feet seem to know which way they're going. I turn left and find myself on an incline, ascending a tree-flanked slope. The faint tinkle of a bell prompts me to stand aside as an urban cyclist in luminous lycra zips past, coasting in the opposite direction. Item. Angleton wants to use me as a tethered goat, but I'm not much use to him if I'm not in the right place when the Goatfuckers come calling.
Damn. I hope he gets my message via the Memex. Where are we leaking? Is it via the Bloody Baron Committee? That seems to be the logical place, but... A chill creeps over me, and I glance up at a turbid cloudscape that wasn't there 5 minutes ago. Swirling masses of dirty cumulonimbus crammed with a promise of rain to come. Uh-oh. Here's me, out and about in a lightweight summer jacket. I really ought to head for home. I keep walking because it seems like the thing to do, although the shadows are lengthening among the dark green trees to either side. The cycle path is empty. I ought to start looking for an exit from it that'll take me back down to street level and a bus stop or tube station. I glance behind me, but I can't see the ramp I came up anymore. Item: Dr. Mike's research finding about the early onset of Case Nightmare Green. Let's hypothesize that the goatfuckers heard about it by way of our security breach. We know the goatfuckers want Case Nightmare Green to come about. They're fans of the old dead nightmares that will stalk the planet once more. They worship the things. How twisted is that? Ford's new finding suggests that the onset conditions for tearing a hole in the structure of reality are a bit more flexible than we previously thought, which suggests that there are things the goatfuckers can do to accelerate the onset of apocalypse. The stars coming right, as the pulp writer put it. They're showing an interest in the Eater of Souls. Why? Do they think that if they get their hands on the Fuller memorandum, they can control him? Make him do something unspeakable that will shiver the stars in their tracks and split the skies apart like... I look up. Oh, fuck. Then I shut my mouth and save my breath for more important activities. Like, for example, running away. While I have been wandering aimlessly, locked in my head, my feet have guided me onto a dismal path. There are no cyclists or pedestrians in sight, just an endless dark strip of tarmac that curves out of sight ahead and behind me, surrounded by impenetrable walls of spiny evergreen shrubs that lean inwards above my head. I can't see through the hedge, but there are pallid mushroom-like structures bursting from the soil around their roots. The cloudscape overhead is turbulent and dappled, side-lit by sunlight slanting under its floor, even though there are hours yet to go until sunset, and the ever-shifting whirlpools and knots of darkness roll and dance, lit from within by the snapshots of cosmic paparazzi. I have no idea how I got here, and I'm not amused with myself for succumbing to what was, at a guess, a very low-key glamour, but the urge to get out and find a safe refuge is overwhelming. Every instinct is screaming that I'm in immediate danger, and so I begin to jog, just as the U-boat klaxon starts to honk urgently from my breast pocket. Bob? It's Mo. I'm kind of busy right now, I pant. What's up?
The memo I was after, are you sure it wasn't in?
Huh?
I'm dead sure. Listen, what was it about? That external appraisal of my violin. I told you about that, remember?
Oh, that.
The examiner was murdered about 36 hours ago. Bob, if they think you've got the violin report...
Listen, let me give you an update. I've been suspended on pay. I need you to pick up a ward for me as soon as you can. I'm heading home now, but I'm in a spot of bother and they took my pistol. Angleton isn't AWOL. Can you find him and tell him he was right? The goatfuckers are after the bait and I need backup right now.
The Necronomipod beeps at me 3 times and drops the call.
Fuck!
I thumbtap the software ward back to life, then shove the Jesus phone back in my pocket and keep jogging, breathing heavily now. There's a breeze in my face, shoving me back and slowing me down, and the surface of the footpath feels greasy and turgid, almost sticky. The sense of wrongness is overwhelming. I have a sense of déjà vu, harking back to my midnight run, although that path was miles away and didn't look anything like... Oh... Am I on a siding? I ask myself, as the headwind builds and the shadows deepen. I hear distant thunder and the first heavy slap of raindrops on the path ahead. Did the Necropolitan line have branches that were edited out of the public record decades ago, by any chance? The hoarse scream of a ghostly steam whistle echoes in my ears. It's behind me, and it's gaining ground. It's funny how you lose track of a situation while it spins out of control. In the space of about 15 minutes, I've let myself be led by the nose, or rather the feet, from a busy suburban high street in London right into an occult trap. There are places where the walls of reality are thin, the the service corridors of hotels, subway footpaths at night, hedge mazes and cycle paths. You can get lost in such places, led astray by a lure and a snare and a subliminal suggestion. These routes blend into one another. Of all the myriad ways that link the human realm to the other places, these are the ones we know very little about, because those of us who stumble into them seldom return with their minds intact. I can feel my heart hammering as I run. The hedges to either side brandish spikes edged with an acrious rind of blight. There are pale white shapes embedded in the wall of leaves, the flensed bones of intruders trapped in the interstices of the vegetative barrier. Overhead, the clouds are black as smoke from the funnel of a racing steam locomotive, boiling and raging at the ground. I don't dare look back, even though I'm sure I'm being herded towards an ambush. The phone in my pocket is buzzing and vibrating in urgent Morse, signalling the presence of hostile intent. I need to get off the path. The trouble is, there's nowhere to go. Hang on, I think. Am I seeing true? There is this about the interstitial paths. It takes a fair bit of power to open a gate, and I didn't notice any pentacles and altars draped in eviscerated goats during my walk through the decaying shopping centre. On the other hand, it takes relatively little power to fake up a glamour to provide the illusion of a dark path. Wheezing, I reach for my phone, thumb it on, and slow my stride just enough that I can see the display. Bloody runes, ward detector, turn the camera on the footpath. A silver thread disappearing around the bend ahead of me. I pan sideways, and the camera blurs, then clears, showing me ordinary English nettles and a thinly spaced row of trees pruned well back from the path. It's bright, too, the ground dappled with summer daylight filtered through the branches overhead. Gotcha. I jink sideways towards the menacing hedgerow on my right, slowing, eyes focused on the face of my phone, as the shadows of the thorny wall loom over me. And I crash through a stand of waist-high nettles and narrowly miss a young beech tree as the hedge and the thunderstorm sky vanish like the illusion they are. Ow! I swear under my breath, the hot, bright pinprick sting of nettles rising on the back of my phone hand. I examine the side of the cutting the path runs through. Yes, it's familiar. I've been here before, or somewhere very like it. Except for the lack of pedestrians walking the dog, or cyclists en route from one side of town to the other, it could be a normal bike track. But this one's been warded off. Anyone starting down it who isn't wanted is going to feel a mild sense of dread, rising after a while to an urgent conviction that they need to be anywhere else. I thumb my phone back to the start screen and look for a signal. There's nothing showing. That shouldn't be possible, not on a major network in the middle of a city, but there are zero bars. Do the bad guys have a jammer? It wouldn't be unheard of, and they knew enough to lay a snare right outside the new annex, one tailored for me. That is not good news. I sit down behind a tree, careful to check that I'm concealed from the path by that stand of stinging nettles, and then I do something that's overdue. I compose an email to the two people I know I can trust. Angleton and Moe. The Jesus phone is smart enough to keep looking for a connection, and to send the mail as soon as it snags a signal. Then I compose a slightly different email to a whole bunch of people I don't entirely trust, remembering to include Angleton and Moe on the recipient list, and send it. Now that should set the cat among the pigeons. My heartbeat is just about back to normal by the time I finish, and my lungs aren't burning anymore. So I slide my phone into an inside jacket pocket, and stand up. Click clack.
Don't move.
Chapter 12. Countermeasures. Meanwhile, over on the other side of the looking glass. Listen, let me give you an update. I've been suspended on pay. I need you to pick up a ward for me as soon as you can. I'm heading home now, but I'm inaudible. And they inaudible. Can you find him and tell him inaudible? Mo sighs, exasperated, as her phone beeps three times and hangs up on Bob. She waits 5 seconds, then hits redial. It connects immediately. Hello, you have reached the voicemail of... She puts her phone away, leaving it for later. Bob's obviously in a poor reception zone, but if he's heading home, they can compare notes in a couple of hours. Being suspended is bad news for Bob, but she's been half expecting it. They've both been under too much pressure lately. the business with the cultists, the suspected leak, all the other minutiae of being part of the operational front end of an organization under increasing strain. Everyone is under strain these days, even the people who aren't cleared to know about Dr. Mike's bombshell. Mo heads towards an anonymous industrial estate in the suburbs, out near Croydon, where some of the more technical departments have relocated while service house is being rebuilt. She travels by tube and then commuter train, and finally by bus, keeping one hand on her violin case at all times. It takes her an hour and a half to make the journey, strap hanging in grim silence, alone with her worries about the evidence she removed from Mr. Dower's workshop. She travels under the gaze of cameras, cameras on the tube platforms, cameras in the railway station concourses, cameras on the buses. Many of them are linked to the Scorpion Stair network, part of the huge surveillance web the government is spinning to keep the nation safe in the final days. But the final days may be about to arrive with a bang 2 or 3 years earlier than anticipated. She walks the 100 meters to the car park entrance, then enters an anonymous-looking office reception area in an otherwise windowless building. A plain signboard on the high, razor-wire-topped fence outside proclaims it the property of Invicta Security Limited, and the portrait of a slavering German shepherd beneath the sign promises a warm welcome to would-be burglars. Both signs are, of course, lying. The building currently houses most of the occult forensics department, and there's no easy way to visually depict the protean, gelatinous horrors that ooze around the premises by night.
Hello, Invicta.
The blue suitor behind the counter pauses.
Dr. O'Brien, can I see your pass, please?
Mo presents her warrant card.
Hi, Dave. Is Dr. Williams in?
I think so.
Dave pokes at his computer terminal.
Yes, he's booked in. Do you need to see him?
I've got a job on. Can you page him?
I'll do that.
Dave points a webcam on a stalk at her, then prints off a temporary badge.
Here, wear this. It's valid for zones 1 and 2. You know the drill.
Yes.
Mo doesn't smile. Whereas the new annex mostly deals with paper, apart from the armory, the OFD handles physically, and in some cases spiritually, hazardous materials. Access to the inner zones is restricted for good reason. While Dave pages Dr. Williams, Mo plants herself on one of the powder blue waiting area seat things and idly pages through some of the magazines on the occasional table. Forensic Sciences Digest, Gunshot Wounds Monthly, Witch, PCR. Her attention is a million kilometers away from the articles, but they serve as a distraction for her eyes. She has one of the magazines open at a color spread of spent bullets retrieved from victims of crime when a shadow falls across her.
Mo, what brings you out here?
She looks up, forcing a smile.
Nick, are you busy? Can we discuss this in your office?
5 minutes later, another windowless office with overflowing bookshelves and too many filing cabinets.
What have you got for me?
He asks. Balding, in his late 40s, Nick is the research lead in this particular lab.
A special job.
Mo pauses.
Sub Rosa.
Sub...
Oh, shit. Tell me it isn't so.
She shakes her head.
I think it's probably a leak rather than an inside job, but even so, this is for you, not the office junior. Eyes only.
She pulls out the tub of paperclips from Mr. Dower's workroom and the small stapler from beside his cash register and places them on the work table opposite Dr. Williams' desk.
The owner of these items was murdered about 48 hours ago. He just prepared a special report for me. I'm pretty certain the killer took the report, and knowing George, the victim, he would have paperclipped or stapled it. So I want a full read on the top copy and a locator.
Dr. Williams whistles between his front teeth.
You don't want March, do you?
He pauses.
When do you need it by? Right now.
Mo positions her violin case on the visitor's chair, then lets go of it.
It's very urgent. Oh, I can have it with you by 8 tonight if I...
No. She smiles, letting him see her teeth.
When I said no, I meant right now. What's so urgent?
Williams, unwilling to be rushed, crosses his arms and stares at her.
Are you on the distribution for Club Zero?
Williams's face turns ashen.
That was the business in Amsterdam, wasn't it? They're over here, too. The document in question is a detailed report on that. she points at the violin case. Whoever has got the report is almost certainly a live hostile. And may I remind you that the item thereafter is in your office? Her smile evaporates. You really want to get me out of here. There is a philosophy by which many people live their lives, and it is this. Life is a shit sandwich, but the more bread you've got, the less shit you have to eat. These people are often selfish brats as kids, and they don't get better with age. Think of the shifty-eyed, smarmy asshole from the sixth form who grew up to be a merchant banker, or an estate agent, or one of the Conservative Party funny handshake minds a Rolex brigade. This isn't to say that all estate agents or merchant bankers or conservatives are selfish, but that these are ways of life that provide opportunities for people of a certain disposition to enrich themselves at the expense of others. Bear with me. There is another philosophy by which people live their lives, and it goes thus. You will do as I say, or I will hurt you. It's petty authoritarianism, and it frequently runs in families. Dad's a dictator, mum's henpecked, and the kids keep quiet if they know what's good for them, all the while soaking up the lesson that mindless obedience is the only safe course of action. These kids often rescue themselves, but some of them don't. They grow up to be thugs, insecure and terrified of uncertainty, intolerant and unable to handle backchat, willing to use violence to get what they want. Let me draw you a Venn diagram with two circles on it, denoting sets of individuals. They overlap, the greedy ones and the authoritarian ones. Let's shade in the intersecting area in a different color and label it dangerous. Greed isn't automatically dangerous on its own, and petty authoritarians aren't usually dangerous outside their immediate vicinity. But when you combine the two, you get gangsters and dictators and hate-spewing preachers. There is a third philosophy by which, thankfully, only a tiny minority of people live their lives. It's a bit harder to sum up, but it begins like this. In the beginning was the endless void, and the void spawned the elder things, and we were created to be their slaves, and they're going to return to Earth in the near future, and it is only by willingly subordinating ourselves to their merest whim that we can hope to survive. Now let me drop another circle on the diagram, and scribble in the tiny patch where it intersects with the other two circles, and label it in deepest fuliginous black. Here be monsters. Greedy, check. Authoritarian, check. Worshippers of the most bizarre anti-human monsters you can imagine, check. That's the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh, and their masks like the Free Church of the Universal Kingdom, and all of their ilk. Hateful, dangerous, unpleasant, greedy, and all-around bad people who you don't want to have anything to do with if you can help it. There's just one problem with this picture. That bit about, in the beginning was the endless void? They're right. Oops. Here's the problem. We live in a hideously reticulated multiverse, where most of the dimensionality of space-time is hidden from our view, curved in on themselves in closed loops, tucked away in imaginary spaces. But the stuff we can observe is a tiny fraction of the entirety of what we live in. Magic, the stuff I deal with in the office on a day-to-day basis, involves the indirect manipulation of information flow through these unseen dimensions, and communication with the extra-dimensional entities that live elsewhere. I'm an applied computational demonologist. How can I not believe this stuff? Not the bit about original creation. Oh no. Beings like Nyarlathotep didn't mould us out of the black clay of the Nile Delta. I've got no beef with modern cosmology, but those of them who take an interest in our kind find it useful for humans to believe such myths, and so they encourage the cultist numpties through their pursuit of forbidden lore. We aren't alone in this cosmos. We aren't even alone on this planet, as anyone who's met a blue Hades can attest. There's a reason all those domed undersea cities of the future never got built in the 1950s. And don't get me started on Deep Seven, the lurkers in the red-hot depths. But our neighbours, the Deep Ones and the Thonians, are adapted for wildly different biospheres. There is no colonial overlap to bring us to the point of conflict, which is a very good thing, because the result would be a very rapid game over, humans lose. The things that keep me awake in the small hours aren't anything like as approachable as a Deep One. Hell, I've worked with a Deep One, left a part of my soul behind with her. No matter. The things that terrify me
are blue-green worms, twisting and coiling luminous intrusions, glimpsed in the abruptly emptied eyes of a former colleague. Minds patient and incomprehensibly old, that find amusement in our tortured writhing. Boltzmann brains from the chaotic, necrotic depths of the distant future, reaching back through the thinning ultrastructure of space-time to idly toy with our reality. Things that go bump in the night eternal. Things that eat us. There is a fourth and final philosophy by which some of us live our lives, and it boils down to this. Do not go quietly into that dark night. Draw a fourth circle on that now crowded Venn diagram, and you'll see that while it intersects the greedy and authoritarian circles, and even has a tiny overlap with the greedy authoritarian bit, it doesn't quite intersect with a third circle, the worshippers. It holds up a mirror to their self-destruction. Call it the circle of the necromantic apostates. That's where I stand, whether I'm greedy or authoritarian or both. I don't think I'm either, but how can I be sure? I may believe in mind-eating horrors from beyond space-time, but they'll have to break my neck before I bend it to their yoke. Keep telling yourself that, Bob. Mo carries her violin and follows Dr. Williams as he picks up a chipped plywood tea tray and backs through a swinging door, carrying the jar of paperclips and the stapler. The glass window in the door is hazed by a fine wire mesh, and the edges of the door are lined with copper fingers that close against a metal strip inside the frame. Williams places the tray on one end of an optical workbench, then bolts the door and flips a switch connected to a red lamp outside his office.
"You've worked with one of these before?"
he asks.
"Of course."
Mo shrugs out of her jacket and hangs it on a hook.
"It's the entanglement retrieval bit I'm unfamiliar with. That, and I may need a lab report. I know my limits." "Good."
Williams's smile is humorless.
"Then if I tell you to stay in the isolation grid over there, you know what the consequences are for getting things wrong."
"Indeed." She opens the violin case and removes her bone-white instrument and its bow. Williams stares at it for a moment.
"Do you really need that?"
"When I said they're targeting me, I wasn't exaggerating. Besides, the document they stole was a report on this very instrument. If they're trying to backtrack from it to find the original, then when you bring up the Adams Tote resonance, it might lead them here."
Dr. Williams snorts.
"I'm sure the front desk will be very happy to see them."
He turns to the bench and unclamps a swinging arm, uses it to position a glass diffraction grating in a path defined by a set of curious pentagonal prisms positioned at the 10 vertices of an irregular pentacle.
"Would you pass me the data logger? It's the second one along on the top shelf."
It takes Dr. Williams a quarter of an hour to set up the forensic magician's workbench. Apart from the odd geometric layout, it doesn't resemble the popular imagination's picture of a sorcerer's laboratory. Coloured chalk lines and eye of newt are gone, replaced by solid-state lasers and signal generators. Pointy hats and robes have given way to polarised goggles and lab coats. The samples, stripped of their containers, are transferred to windowed containers using Perspex tongs. Williams slots them into place in the observation rig.
"Okay, stations," he says conversationally. "I haven't modified the beam line, so there should be no overspill, but I'll run a low power test first, just in case."
Mo and the forensic demonologist move to stand inside complex designs inlaid in the floor in pure copper.
"How's your personal ward?" he asks.
Mo reaches for the fine silver chain around her neck.
"Mine's fine," she says slowly.
"Damn, I should have drawn a spare for Bob. It's a bit late now. Do you have any kicking around?"
"I'll see what I can do afterwards. Okay, goggles on, lights going out. Testing in 10, 9, 8.
He pushes a switch. The red laser beam is only visible where it passes through the prisms.
"You getting any overspill?"
"None."
The room is dark, the only light source the faint trickle through the thickly frosted glass of the window in the door.
"Good."
Williams cuts the power, then reaches across the bench by touch and rotates the sample tubes a quarter turn, lining them up with the beam path. Then he adjusts a mirror, flipping it to face a different and bulkier laser.
"Okay, I'm switching to the high power source, going live in 10, 9, 8.
An image shimmers faintly in the darkness, stitched out in violet speckles across the translucent face of the screen on the optical bench. A pallid rectangle, violet with black runes.
That might be it, Mo says quietly.
I expect so. I'm upping the power.
The rectangle fills in, glowing brighter and brighter.
Okay, I'm exposing the photographic paper now.
What kind of camera?
Pinhole with two holes. Yes, it's a double split interferometer. Quiet now.
There's a soft click. 10 seconds later, there's another click.
Okay, I got the exposure done. Shame we can't use CCDs for this job, but you wouldn't want to feed some of the things we look at to a computing device. Right, you want to look at the bearer?
Yes. Mo leans forward, careful to stay within her ward, which glows pale blue, the nacreous glimmer washing over her feet.
It might retrieve Mr. Dower. I can identify him. If it's anyone else, I'd like a portrait, please.
I'll just reload the interferometer. Wait one... Okay, I'm ready. Now comes the fun bit. Do you know Zimbardo's second right?
Mo pauses for a while.
I think so.
Good, because we're going there. Don't worry, your part isn't hard. Let's get started.
After 5 minutes of minute adjustments, Williams runs a certain specialized script on his workstation, which starts up a soundtrack of chants in an esoteric language and sends a sequence of commands to the microcontrollers in the workbench. As the baritone voices intone meaningless syllables with the mindless precision of a speech synthesizer, he whispers to her,
"Some visitors say it spoils the fun, but I rather think it's better than taking the risk of a slip of the tongue."
A new image begins to fuzz into being in the screen. The drawn face of a male, 50-something, wearing an expression of intent concentration.
"That's Dower," Mo confirms.
"He wrote the report.
Who do you get next?"
"Let's see. It'll cycle through the bearers soon enough."
Dower's face is melting, morphing into a likeness. Mo's breath catches in her throat.
"Shit.
You get around, do you?"
Williams sounds amused.
"No, I told you they're targeting me directly."
She stops, her voice rising.
"It would be the best way to get the report out of Dower. Send an agent who looks like me."
"I believe you."
The amusement drops from his voice.
"Thousands wouldn't."
"Let them." She takes a deep breath. "Is there anyone else?"
"Wait."
The face is fading slowly. As it dims, Mo sees a faint shimmer about the eyes, the only sign that it may be a false sending. Whoever is behind the glamour is very good.
"Come on, come on,"
Dr. Williams murmurs under his breath. Mo shifts her weight uneasily from one foot to the other, as she does when her feet are complaining about too many hours in smart shoes. She glances sidelong into the darkness, where the shadows are swirling and thickening. A faint spectral scatter of spillage from the violet laser shimmers across the wall.
"Any res..."
She's in the process of turning her head back towards Dr. Williams and the workbench as the imago shudders and distorts, twisting into another's face. Williams is meticulous and doesn't cut corners. This is why he and Mo survive. There's a crack like a gunshot, and two near simultaneous bangs from the power supplies that feed the workbench. High-speed Krytron switches short the output to Earth. A rattle of broken glass follows, as shards from the diffraction screen and some of the pentaprisms follow. The synthesized voices stop. Seconds later, a thin wisp of smoke begins to curl from the top of the laptop.
"Sitrep,"
snaps Williams.
"Contained and uninjured. Yourself?"
Mo raises a hand to her cheek. One finger comes away damp with blood. Not uninjured. The pain hasn't reached her yet.
"Keep your goggles on and stay in the grid until I say you're clear."
The smoke is nauseatingly thick. Williams reaches out with a Perspex tongs and flips the light switch.
"Thermometer says we're grounded. Clear to step out of the grid,"
he demonstrates.
"Damn, what a mess."
Mo swallows.
"Is there a CCTV track?"
"What did I tell you earlier about images and computers?" "No, but we ought to be able to confirm whether it's your document."
He sounds unhappy.
"Did you get a glimpse of whatever that was?"
She nods. Been there, done that.
Countermeasures.
Williams makes an obscenity of the word.
Does that tell you anything useful?
Yes. Mo picks up her handbag from the workbench on the opposite wall, hunting for a tissue.
Whoever's got the report knows what it is, and they're willing to fight to keep it.
She draws a deep, shuddering breath.
Do you have a secure voice line? I need to make a call.
Click-clack.
Don't move.
I stand very still. The sound of a shotgun slide being racked at a range of less than 3 meters is a fairly good indication that your luck has run out, especially if you can't see where the shooter's positioned.
Very good, Mr. Howard.
The speaker is Mayo, standing somewhere behind me. He's on the embankment, of course. Even the B-team learn eventually. Maybe I should have tried to shoot them the other night. And maybe I should cultivate my inner psychopath some more. Oh well.
Do what I say, and they won't shoot you. If you understand, nod.
I nod like a Churchill dog, thinking furiously. His accent is odd. Welsh? I can't place it.
When I stop speaking, I want you to slowly remove your pistol and place it on the ground in front of you. Then I want you to turn around. Do you understand?
But I'm not.
Did I ask you to speak?
His voice is icy. I shut up fast.
If you understand, nod,
he repeats. I nod. It's not my job to disillusion him about my imaginary invisible handgun. Like I said, the B-team are more dangerous than the A-team, just like sweating dynamite is more dangerous than Semtex.
Do it, he says. Do it very slowly, or I'll shoot you.
I very slowly lift the right side of my jacket and mime unhooking a non-existent pistol from a non-existent belt clip. Then I lean over sideways until I nearly topple over and lower my hand towards the roots of a tree. Finally, I straighten up, still moving slowly, and turn round, raising my hands. My first reaction is, a man without a face is pointing a shotgun at me. Then I realize that he's glammed up, his head masked by a shimmer of random snapshots of other people, like something out of a Philip K. Dick novel. Other than that, he's wearing jeans and a grey hoodie, just like a million other men in and around this great capital city. The only deviant part of the ensemble is the tactical shotgun.
Take 2 steps downhill until you're on the path, he tells me. Then kneel with your hands on top of your head.
My heart, barely under control a minute ago, is pounding, but I do what he tells me to do. Arguing with a shotgun isn't clever. I manage to kneel with my hands on my head, which is harder than you might think when the ground's uneven, you're amped up on adrenaline, and you're over 30. And wait.
Don't move, he says.
The sun beats down on us as we wait in a frozen diorama for almost a minute. Then I hear footsteps and a jingling sound from behind.
Don't move,
repeats Mr. Faceless, as someone takes hold of my left wrist and clips one ring of a pair of handcuffs around it.
Got him, boss,
says another male voice. Shit, I think, tensing and ready to make a move if the opportunity presents. But they're not total idiots, and they've already got my other wrist.
Now lay down, says Mr. Faceless.
What can I do? I take a dive, making a controlled sprawl forward on the dusty cycle path, thinking they wouldn't be doing this if they were going to kill. Mr. Faceless's companion plants one knee on the small of my back and thrusts a sickly, sweet-smelling wad of cotton under my nose. Me? The lights go out.
This ends Disc 6.